This is Sign Language with Bruce Williams and Doc Goldstein.
Hi, and welcome to episode 170 of Sign Language. This is Bruce Williams from signlanguagepodcast.com.
And this is Doc. How are you guys?
Yeah, how are you, mate?
I'm good.
Excellent.
Here in sunny Southern California, you know, other side of the world from you guys.
That's exactly right.
It's not even the same day where I am and where you are. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, exactly. It's Saturday afternoon for you and Sunday morning for me.
That's right. We do audio and time travel. That's exactly it.
Before we get into this episode, I wanted to give a bit of a shout out to Mick Rooney, who long-time listeners to this podcast will know that name. Mick is a mate of mine. He lives here in Sydney, and he developed a great piece of software called AA Translator. For those who are new to the party, the backstory is Mick runs a little project studio out in the western suburbs of Sydney, and he always used, and to the best of my knowledge is still using, Adobe Audition. And what would happen was he would get these bands who would come to record at his studio, and they'd have some pre-production that they'd done in things like Pro Tools or Logic, and they'd want to use that as they were recording in his studio. And Mick is a software engineer, and so what he did was he back-engineered or, you know, reverse-engineered all of these different multi-track audio editing software languages, if you like for all of the different types of session file, and made it so that you could translate any session file from any platform into Adobe Audition and then translate it back from Audition back to Pro Tools or Logic or whatever the system was, so that these clients of his could then take what he'd recorded in Audition back home in their own format and continue working on it. So AA Translator grew out of that. And so these days it's this piece of software that'll allow you to open any DAW format session file and output it into any other DAW session file format. And Mick has just released a fairly significant update. It's version 6.3, and I just thought I'd give him a shout out. I'm on his mailing list, and I'm just looking at the list of things that he's added. I'm not even going to run through it because there's so many things there. So for anyone who's, you know, been looking for a way to move sessions between one format and another, you definitely want to check out AA Translator. And I'm not sure if the URL is aatranslator.com.au. I'll have to look that up, and I will find it, and I will put it in the show notes for this episode. So if anyone's looking for it, the other option is to check, just do a Google search for Sweet Spot Studios. Sweet as in S-U-I-T-E. So good work, Mick. Keep up the good work, mate. Love it. So, yeah. What's your week been like, Doc?
Well, my week's been good. But before I go there, on this software that you were talking about, I'm wondering if it works between Ableton Live and Pro Tools, because that would be handy.
Basically, this software eventually evolved into the point where I think there's about 10 or 12 different formats of session file that are now supported, and you can go from any one of them to any of the other 11. You know, so it's an amazingly competent piece of software.
That's really great. And obviously, you wouldn't be raving about it unless your software was in there, right? It's Reaper friendly, right?
Reaper is in there. Pro Tools is in there. I'm pretty sure Ableton is in there. I know Cubase and Nuendo are both in there. I think Saw is in there. I don't know if anyone still uses Saw, but I think Logic is in there.
Well, that's interesting. You know, some of these workstations have such a different feature set. Like, for example, Ableton Live, you know, works so differently from Pro Tools,
right,
that I would guess that there are some features that aren't supported when you go back
exactly
and forth.
Exactly. And he's done a really good job in the interface of AA Translator of making it clear what things are supported between, you know, your source and your intended destination and what things aren't. So, you know, some DAWs will support, you know, like VST plugins applied only to a clip as opposed to applied to a track. So if you have things like that, you know, the software will tell you, hey, you know, I'm not going to be able to translate that little part of it because the destination format doesn't support that feature.
Right.
So it's pretty cool because it'll allow you to export and work with OMFs and AAFs as well. So it's a very handy little piece of software.
It sounds very useful. We used to use a thing called Barbabatch, which I think did some similar stuff, but it doesn't. It'd be interesting to see what the differences are between them. And
yeah, right.
That, and we'll look at that. That's good. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
No worries. So we got a very interesting email through the week from Theodore Goodman. He said, "Hi, I've been listening to the new episodes as they arrive. I usually like to do research on my own before firing off questions. However, I'll lob a couple of questions and comments your way as a possible stimulus for ideas for the podcast. A question from a listener in one of the early episodes of the rebooted podcast was regarding computer noise in a studio. Consider that tablet computers, NUC boxes, etc. are quite powerful these days. At the beginning of the year, now about a year ago, I bought two used or refurbished tablets that were high-end items in mid-2014 when they were new. 8 gig of RAM, 256 gig SSD, 4 logical cores. These do have fans, though the fans are not loud and can be disabled at the cost of some processing power to reduce heat. Powerful, silent computers are possible these days and cheap. A big topic that both of you could discuss at length is multiband compression. I use Audition 301, which has an Isotope multiband compressor via VST plugin. Although I'm an engineer, as in electrical and computer, and understand generally what compressors do, I find my use of them to be trial and error. Any ideas about how to select the bands for multiband, attack and release times for each band, attack and release times for the brick wall limiter, and all the other compression settings for each band? What do you recommend for audio interfaces and signal routing to make multi-track recordings of live sound from a mixer? The recordings are to serve as technical references to examine what worked, what didn't, where feedback came from, etc., after a live event is over. Assume the mixer does not have a lot of buses available, so the job would probably have to be done via cabling, such as Y splitters or using insert jacks. That should do for now. I don't want to shovel too much on you all at once. Theodore Goodman." Theodore, thank you, mate. That's a great bunch of questions.
Yeah, yeah. Multiband compression. Ooh.
Yeah, that's a massive can of worms, and I honestly think we need to dedicate a whole episode to just compression in a broadband sense before we tackle multiband. Would you agree?
I would agree, and I would just say that multiband compression is one of those tools where you can really hurt yourself if you're not careful. For those of you who have it, and you know, Isotope is a great company, and they make a lot of great plugins. But for those of you that have multiband compression, until you've really, you know, at least listened to us yak about it on our podcast that we're going to do, I might hold back, because you know it can be great, but it can also make things sound overprocessed in a hurry.
Yeah,
you know, and trying to unwind that.
You know, I started podcasting with my first podcast was called Building the Pod, Understanding Adobe Audition, and some of the people who are now listening to Sign Language have come with me right from the very beginning back in 2005, and for a long time, I would say probably 8 or 9 years after that point, I was always saying that I never went near multiband compression because I didn't understand it enough, and I knew how much damage I could do with it by not understanding it. And it's probably only in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years that I've actually started to use it on occasion, and only when I felt like I couldn't get what I wanted simply with EQ. But it is a massive can of worms, and you, as Doc suggested, you really need to understand compression as a, you know, full frequency tool before you start mucking around with a multiband compressor. Because don't understand what it can do to the whole frequency range, you're just going to end up in a big bucket of doggy doo before you know it with a multiband.
Well, we had another listener send us an email saying that he would like us to go over compression again, even though we've done it before.
Yeah.
And I think we should do that. And there's a lot of this, because it's one of the most important tools that we have in recording and mixing. It's just
definitely.
I remember Mike Chapman was quoted as saying that it's probably more important than any other type of effect that he uses. And I don't know Mike Chapman, but I know his work. You know, he produced Blondie and a bunch of other fantastic, you know, acts, and he's an amazing producer and engineer. And I would take it from him on that. So I think we should do a big show on that, maybe even a two-parter, depending on how deep we get into it, because there's so much. I mean, there's type of compression, type of gain cell. Is it peak? Is it RMS-based?
Yep.
Attack time, decay time. Is it over-easy curve? You know, has it got vacuum tubes in it, or is it—
Is it feed-forward or feedback topology?
Yes. Yeah. Well, API, you can have either, right? On an API 527, you can do either. That's not a plug for API, because I don't work for them, but I do like their stuff, but I don't work for them. But I would just say that there's so much to cover. One thing I do tell people who are just starting out, though, start out by intentionally using, well, on tracks that don't matter much, start out by using entirely too much so that you can get used to what it sounds like. And then when you back off, you can hear what it's doing. Because I run into the situation a lot of time where newbies don't really hear it.
Oh, look, funny you should mention that, right? When I was about 2 or 3 years into my career, so that would make it around about 1989, I went and spent a day at another radio station, basically looking over the shoulder of a much more experienced engineer than myself, a guy who I really looked up to. He was, you know, the king of promo producers in Australia at the time. And he was doing an acoustic session with a band who were in the radio station that particular day. And I'm standing in the corner watching as he was, you know, setting this all up, getting ready to record. And he was listening to, you know, one of the— I can't even remember if it was a guitar or a vocal or something. And he sort of turned and looked at me and went, "That compressor's biting a little bit too hard, isn't it?" And I just kind of shrugged. I'm like, "What the hell? I have no idea. I can't hear that." and it was funny, you know, because I went away after that day, you know, having asked him a few more questions after the band had done their thing and left the studio. And I went away and really made a concerted effort to listen to compression when it was, you know, extreme and when it was subtle, and to try and hear what it was doing to the signal. I understood the theory of it, but I had no concept of what it was meant to sound like to the ear. And I honestly think it probably took me another 12 to 18 months before I really got it. You know, before I could listen to a signal and go, "Oh yeah, that's been really heavily compressed," or that could really use a bit more compression. It took me that long to really get it into my head. I don't know if you recall, you know, right back in your early days, Doc, whether your learning curve was like that or whether you just got it straight away. I don't know, but
well, back then I was still trying to carve flint arrowheads, you know, so. What can I say? To quote Graham Edge from the Moody Blues, that's when my hair was brown and my teeth were white. So that was a long time ago. Yeah, back to that. So compression is so useful, and it can really make the difference between a recording or a mix that is the difference between amateur night and professional sounding. But you have to know what you're doing, and you have to learn to use it.
Yeah.
And it's more complicated by the fact that hardware and software still don't sound the same. And plugins, and I'm not against plugins, I just know that I don't expect them to sound just like the hardware they're emulating, because they don't. But they can sound close.
Yeah.
But they don't sound exactly the same. So sometimes I'll come out of my rig into some analog equipment and then back into the rig again just to pick up compression or stuff like that. So
yeah, right. See, that's interesting. I've never had the opportunity to AB a hardware compressor with a software emulation of that particular compressor. That would be a very interesting comparison to do.
I've been able to do that. You know, I've been pretty lucky in that regard.
And you really do notice a significant difference between the hardware and the software emulation?
I like the hardware better.
Yep.
I think plugins are about 90%. You know, some of them are not that good, but some of the good ones are 90% there. But there's, for example, I have an LA-2A hardware, and there's just something about, you know, talk about magic boxes. You know, there's just something about what that can do to a vocal or a bass guitar that you just, let's put it this way. I have never gotten it to sound as magic through a plugin as that. But that doesn't mean plugins don't sound good. And I would say that nobody listens to a mix that somebody else did and goes, "Oh, I don't like that. I can tell it's plugins." No,
exactly.
Nobody says that. No. But when you're actually there with the tracks and you're mixing and you compare, you hear something different between them. You know,
right?
And, there will be a time when you don't. You know, they'll get past that someday, but they're not there yet.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned the LA-2A because I not long ago bought the Waves Chris Lord Algae compressor plug-in bundle, which gives you the LA-2A, the LA-3A, and the LA-76, which is an 1176 emulation.
Right.
But yeah, like I said, I've never had the opportunity to compare that with any of the hardware boxes of which they are based. So that would be interesting.
I have an 1176 that I tried to sell on eBay, but I didn't get any buyers. So anybody out there, yeah. You know, and it's an old one. You know, it's not the new UA. It's an old original.
Wow. Why are you getting rid of that?
Well, because I don't need it. I've got I've got this newer box from UA called a 2 1176, and it's like 2 1176s in one, rack.
So it's a stereo version.
Well, I never use it in stereo, and I'll talk about that in a second, but it's two channels of it, and instead of having push buttons, it's all knobs, but it sounds really good, and so I find myself just not using the other one. Now, I will say, though, that because they're in one box, there is a link switch so that you can run it in stereo. And I really don't care for it that way.
Okay.
So I use it. I just don't like it. It sounds a little dark to me when you use it as a stereo. I wouldn't put it on a mix bus or something like that, or, you know, whatever. But I really love the way it sounds as individual channels, and I use it a lot. Sometimes I'll come out of that. I'll do a really quick peak detection on vocal peaks, and then I'll come out of that into the LA-2A to smooth everything out, and then back into the workstation. You know, some people go into the LA-2A first. You know, so that's you know, we'll bring that up as part of the whole, you know, aforementioned advertised upcoming but not yet recorded compressor episode.
Definitely,
and EQ is different too. You know, digital EQ and analog EQ don't act the same either. And you've probably seen this. You know, did you have analog desks at the radio station?
Well, right back in the beginning of my career, yes, but not recently. I haven't worked on an analog desk now for close on 20 years.
Well, you know, if you're EQing something in analog and you just give it a couple of dB or less than that at some frequency, you can really hear it immediately.
Yeah.
Whereas in digital, sometimes you have to go a lot farther and sometimes even a different frequency to get a similar effect, which is great for room EQ. You know, if you're EQing a room, digital EQ is much better. But if you really want to introduce some, you know, phase shift smearing, because that's how you're getting your vocal sound or something like that, you know, it's tough to do that with digital. So that's a whole nother subject. So it, you know, again, EQ and compression or any plugin, you know, hardware sounds a little bit different than plugins, but I'm not knocking plugins because I use them all the time. And there's a lot of good engineers. You mentioned Chris Lord Algae earlier. I forget if it's him or his brother, and I don't know these guys, but obviously their work is great, really great. But I read somewhere that one of them got rid of all his outboard equipment and is using plugins now because it's just too tough when the record company comes back and they want a stereo NAT flyby to be a quarter of a dB louder. And here you got to try to plug all this crap in and get it just to where it was, which you can't do because analog drifts.
Yep.
Right, resistors change value over time, and things heat up, and it's just so. Just trying to get back to where you were, just so that you can raise that NAT flyby by a half a dB, is just too difficult.
Impossible. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's much easier to open up a session, and all your plugins come up. And same thing with digital consoles. All your routing, you know, instead of a patch bay, you've got a router, and that comes up as part of your session. So you can get back to where you want to be with digital a lot easier. But, definitely, you know, there are things about analog that sound really good.
Hmm.
Some people like to use analog tape machines. I don't, but a lot of people who I respect do.
Yep.
But, you know, you just don't get the dynamic range with tape, and you get more noise, and you get wow and flubber, you know, and all this other stuff. And that's a whole another – there's an entire episode there. So
what was that, analog recording?
Oh, my God.
I actually bought the Waves J37 tape plug-in emulation.
Oh, how is that?
I love it. I love it because you can select two different tape speeds between 7.5 and 15 IPS. You can select three different tape formulations. You can select three different biases. You can dial in as much or as little wow as you want. You can dial in as much or as little flutter as you want. You can dial in as much tape hiss as you want. So it's very flexible in, you know, allowing you to choose which aspects of an analog signal you want to introduce to your, whether it's an individual track or a whole mix. So it's very flexible in that respect. And when I was looking to pick it up, I wasn't sure if I should have gone for that or for the Abbey Road tape emulation. And I did a Google search, you know, Abbey Road Waves tape versus J37, and found a few references. I think they were on Gear Sluts, actually, where some of the guys who had used both pretty much universally said the J37 is better than the Abbey Road plugin. So that was what informed my decision to go with the J37. But yeah, I've loved it. I'll quite often throw it across the bass individual track for the bass in a mix, and then I'll quite often throw it on the master channel, but very subtly in both instances. But yeah, I do love it.
You know, I haven't used that plugin, so I don't want to talk about that one in specifics. But
sure,
it reminds me of a guitar pickup conversation I had with somebody, and I may have mentioned it before. But let's just say, for example, let's just say you're Fender or some other big company, and you want to make a pickup that sounds just like a certain year's pickup sounded, you know, and that's tough to do because they changed, you know, and they're wound by hand, yeah, and everyone was a little bit different. But let's say you finally come up with the recipe to make exactly a certain pickup. Let's just pick a year, 1958, for example.
Okay.
And I'm not talking about a real specific pickup. This is just a story I'm telling, okay?
Sure.
So you make this pickup and you design it great. But what you may not know is that 1958 might have been not the best year for pickups. So what you might do is you might exactly get this pickup to be exactly perfect, and it might really sound like a 1958 pickup, except everybody really wants a 1959 pickup, you know, because it just sounds better. I have a guitar whose brand I won't mention, and I put different pickups in it because I wanted to improve the sound of the guitar. And this guitar came with some authentic remakes of an older pickup, and right, I didn't like it. I didn't like the sound of it. Now, that does that mean that they did a bad job, that it didn't really sound like that old pickup? No. They may have done a perfect job. It just may be that I didn't really care for the job they came up with, even though it was an exact duplication of what was happening on that year. So that, I think the same thing can happen with plugins, is kind of where I'm rambling to.
Yeah, right.
You know, because they model these plugins after specific tape machines, right? They go out, yep, and they get a tape machine or two or three, and they bring them into the shop, and they do either black box or white box programming on it. And we can talk about that if you want. There's different ways of sampling a plugin. And
so just in 100 words or less, what do you mean by white box and black box?
Well, black box is when you just look at how it sounds coming in and out. You're not really looking at every capacitor and resistor in the circuit, whereas white box is you're actually getting in there into the circuitry and emulating all the, right, components in there to come up with the sound, and that's a lot more expensive and takes a lot more time.
Sure. Okay. Yep.
And so I think a lot of software companies do it either way, and I can't tell you which is better because I don't know which ones are which, right?
Yep.
You just know if you like something or not. If you like it, sure. you use it. If you don't like it, you don't use it. So
exactly.
So when people are on a forum and they're saying they like one better than the other, that doesn't necessarily mean that the one they like is more accurate than the other. Maybe the one they don't like is actually more accurate, but with that accuracy comes distortion and wow and flutter and a diminished frequency response and too much hiss.
That's a good point.
So it's not just about copying the good old days. It's about looking at that and maybe picking it and maybe not, dependent upon if you like it or not.
Yeah. Well, based on what I've described of the J37, it sounds to me like that would be a classic example of a white box emulation, because you can access all of those individual idiosyncrasies of that tape machine individually, like through different controls in the UI of that plugin. You know, so you want some wow, you want some flutter, you just dial them in accordingly. You want more tape hiss, great, dial that in. You know, you want to change the tape speed, the tape emulation, blah, blah, blah. All those things are, you know, selectable through the user interface of that plugin. So that would suggest that they, at least for that plugin, definitely went to that level of analyzing every single component of the original hardware. Would you?
Well, I'd very much like to try that plug. I have not tried that one or the Abbey Road one, but I'd definitely be up for trying them both.
I haven't tried the Abbey Road, so.
You know, yeah, I would like to try them both and see what I think.
Yeah.
It might cost, I might have to, you know, pull my wallet out, you know, if I like something.
I think the J37, I think it was only about $59 US, so it's not like it's super expensive.
You know, back in the day, you know, again, back, you know, around the time, you know, like I said before, many people, in terms of hardware, many people thought that the ATR 100 series were the best tape machines, sounding best tape machines ever made. And so a lot of emulations include like an ATR 102, which is a two-track.
Yep. You Who know, made the ATR?
Ampex.
Ah, right. Yep.
And I know that the Studer 800 was also a very popular tape machine.
Yep.
And what we used to do back then, just to see machines fail, is we'd try to record square waves.
Oh, wow.
You know, which reminds me of, since I'm rambling, that reminds me of another acid test. I think that in this letter, he was talking about converters a little bit. Well, I used to do a test that would really show off the weakness of a converter.
Right.
If you really want to make a converter fall to its knees in agony, try recording jingling car keys.
Yeah, right. You've mentioned that before.
Yeah. There's a lot of good converters out there. Some cost a lot and some don't. But that's one test that you can try.
Is that simply due to the amplitude of the high-frequency transients in that sound? Is that what it is, or is there something more to it?
I'm guessing that's what it is. I really can't say for certain, but I tell you what, it'll really show off a bad converter in a hurry, though. So.
And without having actually done it myself, I would hazard a guess that this would be one of those acid tests which would, I'm loath to say prove, but I kind of feel like I want to say it would prove that selecting a lower record level into the converter would go a long way to improving the quality of what you got. I think too many people try and they approach digital recording with an analog mindset of, oh, I've got to absolutely nail the, you know, the input levels right up to the top of the scale.
Oh, yeah.
And with digital, you don't have to do that.
You don't have to do that. Not when, while you're at it, staple these words to your forehead. Do not normalize. Okay, do not normalize, because here you normalize a track and you're one bit away from the end of the digital meter, and then you forget all about it and you run it through a plugin and boost 3 dB at 10K, and now you've got 3 dB of distortion at 10K. So, yeah. You know, do not normalize. But yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
You know, a part of that is because digital full-scale meter is usually about 18 to 20 dB hotter than zero VU.
Yes.
So people need to record at, you know, somewhere down at minus 16, minus 18, minus 20. They might even want to take the time to calibrate their digital meter on their workstation so that it equals zero VU, which equals 1.228 volts, which is plus 4 dBm. And get all that stuff, you know.
You've lost me.
I know, it's Google time.
You've lost me now.
It's Google time. Okay.
I love it.
but at the end of the day, you're right when you say that people treat digital meters as if they're analog. Well, an analog, you want to record around zero VU. That does not mean that you record full scale zero. No. You should be at least 18-20 dB down from there, so you have headroom left.
And we should just put a little asterisk beside this entire conversation, which is the assumption that at the time you are recording at something greater than 16-bit resolution. I don't think Doc would, and I certainly would not recommend tracking at minus 18 dB full scale if you were recording at a 16-bit resolution, because at that point you've seriously compromised the fidelity of your signal. But if you're recording at 24-bit or greater, then you know tracking at minus 18 is going to be fine. Where do you stand on that, Doc?
Okay, so if you're at 16 bits, you have a dynamic range of 96 dB.
That's right.
That's already at least 30 better than any tape machine with noise reduction on it.
That's true.
So sometimes I may have inadvertently recorded a little lower than I'd like, you know, and clip gain is a tool that I will use after the fact if that happened, especially when I have students around. But
so you're saying you inadvertently recorded at 16-bit low?
Well, I don't usually record a 16-bit unless I know I typically use 24, or if I'm using a non-HD system, I'll be at 32 floating. But I'm typically at 24. You know, yeah. I am. But if I was at 16 and I was 16 dB down from the top or 18 dB down from the top, I wouldn't sweat it.
Right. Fair enough.
Because compared to a tape machine, you're still an analog tape machine. You're still in much better shape.
That's true. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Oh man, that's a whole big can of worms there. I remember reading. I don't think it was Gear Sluts. It was somewhere else that I was hanging around. Oh, I think it was on the Reaper forum years ago. And someone was explaining the concept of recording at, 24-bit or greater, knowing that at the end of your production workflow, you are going to mix all of these 24-bit source files into a finished master, which would also be 24-bit, and then you would do your word length reduction and, your peak limiting and whatever else was required at the mastering stage to deliver a 16-bit master file, and that because of the increased resolution right down there in the almost silent region of your WAV files, that it was quite okay to record lower at 24-bit and to then bring the signal up later, knowing that you've still got all of that resolution and you're not going to be bringing up digital square blockiness from the lower regions, and to me, that was quite a challenge to go and actually try it. And I think I only took the plunge because, the guy that was writing the forum or, that particular thread had already proven himself to be very knowledgeable in some other things that he'd said. So I thought, well, I can only give this a go. And his essential mantra was, don't be afraid to record a little bit lower because you're converters will thank you till the cows come home because they can work so much better than when you're, forcing them to work right up to that, last bit before clipping. And that the entire sound of your mix will have, so much more depth to it. And and going and putting that into practice was somewhat of a challenge to someone who was used to constantly recording as hot as the meters would allow.
Well, with analog, you had to do that because you had tape hiss at one end and volume at the other, right? You were trying to get the highest dynamic range you could, but that's not necessary with digital.
For sure, but up until that particular point, I had been using that approach with digital, not knowing any better.
Sure.
And, and it was only when I went away and said, okay, we're going to track this whole song and we're going to track at much lower levels than what I've ever done before. And it's a scary proposition because I've never done it. And I might end up completely destroying the whole recording because we record too low. And then, you get to the end of that production and you run off a mix and you just go, wow, that sounds amazing. And it does. It sounds so much better than when you track everything hot.
Well, this is a good lesson. People should pay attention to what you're saying. Don't even think about getting near the top of the meter. Don't even think about it. Stay in the green. Stay down there in the green all the time.
And what I've learned, and although, you know, Doc can very easily sit there and rattle off voltages and dBm and dBu and all that sort of stuff, and that's stuff that I struggle with. What I have come to understand is that for things which are heavily compressed, things like electric guitars and things like that, you really want your digital input meters to be no hotter than minus 18 at the time of tracking. But if you are recording something which is far more dynamic, like an acoustic guitar, that, you know, you might only be running, you know, a couple of dB of peak limiting on the input, that stuff you can allow to track a little bit hotter because there isn't so much energy in that waveform. But heavily compressed signals like electric guitars and bass, I've found, yes, they do so much better by being tracked at a lower level.
Yeah, I track everything a little bit low and bring it up after I've done a mix. Then I'll use clip gain to bring the mix up to be competitive, but never to clipping. But I tend to record everything somewhere around minus 10 at the loudest, no matter what it is.
Right, you know? Right. So you've mentioned a couple of times clip gain. Is that a plug-in within Pro Tools, or is it something else, or what is it?
It's a feature in plugins where you can take a clip and there's a little fader on the clip and you can raise it there. And which raises a level, the amplitude, but it's separate from the volume range that you can also adjust.
Right.
And so if, for example, one place where you could use it, if you have a stereo instrument and you want them to look like they're the same level on tape or on the workstation, you can just adjust clip gain until they both sound the same. Listen to them, just make sure they're even. Sometimes you don't want them to look the same because that doesn't sound right, because that's not how they were recorded or mic'd. Like on a piano, you know, you might have more volume on the low end than the high end, or you might have it the other way around, and you don't always want to kill that by matching things. But if you do want to match things, like maybe a doubled vocal or something like that, or background tracks, you can use clip gain so that they look the same, so it makes sense when you're mixing and you don't have one fader real high and another one real low, that sort of thing. And clip gain is very handy, but earlier versions of Pro Tools don't recognize it. So like if you're recording in Pro Tools 11 or 12 and then you give that to somebody and they play it back in Pro Tools 9, Pro Tools 9 will not see that clip gain. It won't even know it's there. So you get into that whole thing between versions and did we ever answer Theodore's question?
We haven't answered any of Theo's questions exactly just yet. What I did want, I briefly wanted to go back to his first question from a listener about one of the blah, blah, blah noise in the studio and the idea of using, you know, computers without fans that are available these days. And I thought that's a really interesting point, Theo, and it wasn't one that I'd ever considered. You know, I'm still running a grey box under the desk, you know, that has multiple hard drives in it, and it's got, you know, a fan in the power supply, and it's got three fans on the graphics card, and there's, I think, two or maybe three drives that are all spinning inside that box. So, oh, and then there's a case fan as well. So, you know, there's all this moving parts inside the grey box that's sitting under my desk. But you're right. The technology that's available today in terms of tablets and, you know, laptops that don't use fans and all that sort of stuff, it's a very interesting time. The only thing that would concern me is I'm never happy with the built-in, you know, digital-to-analog converter chips that are on motherboards or tablets. You know, I'd certainly never want to track, you know, quote unquote professional grade audio through one of those things. You know, I would always want to be running a dedicated sound card that is designed, you know, to provide high fidelity audio. And that's my only hesitation with any of those options. Having said that, you take a NUC box.
NUC. Tell me what NUC stands for.
The acronym is New Unit of Computing. And essentially, it is a small box, for those whose memory goes back far enough, probably about the size of two VHS video cassettes sitting one on top of the other. So they're quite small boxes with a very small motherboard. And what they generally will have on them is a you know, an at least one HDMI socket to run out to your monitor, and they'll have two or maybe four USB ports on them. Now, the great thing about USB ports is that there are plenty of really good quality sound cards which can run via the USB bus. And, you know, with USB 2 or even USB 3, you can certainly get enough bandwidth to do multi-channel, high sampling rate, high bit depth audio recording without losing samples on the way. So the sound card that I'm running with now is admittedly about 9 years old, and, you know, it's still doing the job, which is a M-Audio Fast-Track Ultra 8R. This thing is an external 19-inch rack-mounted unit with eight mic pre's in it, and it connects to my grey box via a USB 2 cable. Mm. And I've done plenty of multi-track recording with this system, you know, and it works just fine. So, you know, there are options, you know, like I said, NUCBox with USB ports on it that you could connect a great quality sound card to. That's definitely a viable option. Something like a tablet, which they generally don't have USB ports on them, I'd be a little more wary of. But certainly, yeah, NUCBoxes and things like that, and certainly Raspberry Pi. I mean, that's a whole area I haven't really got into, but I'm very interested in.
Raspberry Pi.
You're not familiar with Raspberry Pi?
I'm not. Okay, so sounds good though. Is it like pumpkin pie?
So this is Pi, spelt P-I, and essentially these are kits that you can go into. Well, here in Australia we have a company called JCar. In America, I'm not sure. Where would you go for electronic kits?
Well, Mojotone makes guitar amp kits, and I'm heavily into guitar amps.
Okay, so I'm thinking more like a retail outlet.
Yeah. Oh, it's Fry's probably. I don't know. It's hard to say. Yeah.
Fry's sort of rings a bell. Maybe that would be where you'd go in the US. But these Raspberry Pi kits can be bought for, you know, like $20-25 US, and essentially it's a small printed circuit board with a bunch of different connectors on it, and you can buy different kits according to what it is you want to build. The great thing about Raspberry Pi is it's so cheap to get into, and you don't have to know how to code software because you generally will install some software on your computer which will allow you to then configure the Raspberry Pi to do what you want it to do. And people are using these things for all kinds of home automation, like switching lights on and off at different times of the day or night. You can set them up as media servers within your home. So, you know, if you download, you know, movies or TV shows or whatever, and you can slap them all on a network attached storage drive and then use the Raspberry Pi to serve those up to your TV or to your computer or to wherever you want to play that media back. There's so many different uses for Raspberry Pi, and there is actually a Raspberry Pi that's dedicated to professional quality audio, and it'll do up to 192k sample rate and, you know, floating point bit depth, and it's just phenomenal what's out there these days.
That sounds really, really good. You know, I'm gonna have to try that. It sounds like Propellerhead's paradise to me.
Oh, totally. You know. And I've deliberately not gone into it because I've thought this would just be another rabbit hole I'll disappear down.
Oh yeah. Yes. I've been in a rabbit hole all week. I have spent the entire last week rebuilding a 1972 Super Reverb to turn it into a 1965 Fender Super Reverb.
And what's the difference?
Well, first of all, I've succeeded. Let me just say that. And I've had some help succeeding. There's a guy named Gerald Weber who has a company called Kendrick, right, with a K. He's in Texas. And I have another friend named Don who lives just a couple of miles from me who has a guitar amp company called Electroplex. Both these guys are geniuses. But at any rate, and they've both been helpful, but there's a lot of people who feel that 60s blackface Fender amps sound better than the 70s silver-faced Fender amps. This is a whole nother rabbit hole that you can go down.
Okay.
Because when CBS bought Fender, there are those who don't like some of the stabilization things they did to the amps because nobody knew then that they wanted the amps to distort. They were trying to make the amps cleaner.
Right.
And I'm one of those people that has that opinion. So I've went ahead and ripped out some of the parts that they put in the early 70s and converted this amp back to what they call blackface specs, which if you look up Fender blackface on the on the web, you'll see all about it. And blackface refers to the fact that the control panel on the top of the amp is black, whereas it's silver. It's got a silver color in the ones that came after that. And so they have things in there like capacitors across the power tubes that flush out some high end that maybe you don't want removed.
Right.
And some of these things in there to make the amp more stable. But instead of doing it that way, you can reroute the internal cabling and move some components around so you don't have parasitic oscillations. And you can make an amp sound just as clean without draining the high end and grounding it out, you know. So,
right.
So I have spent my entire week with my head buried inside the chassis of the Super Reverb, and I'm very happy to say that it's all turned out very well. I will say, though, however, there's a safety proviso.
Yeah.
Tube amps, including guitar amps, can give you a lethal shock even if they're turned off and unplugged because the capacitors in there store energy.
Right.
And you can get zapped. So I'm not suggesting that anybody who doesn't know what they're doing does what I just did all week, okay? I'm just saying, from a safety perspective, you know, you got to be respectful of that. Having said that, I've been having a great time ripping out capacitors and changing values and pulling out old parts that filter capacitors that needed to be replaced and putting in new good sprig parts.
Right.
So the amp sounds amazing. It just sounds so good now.
I'd love to understand all that stuff.
You know,
really would.
Well, you know, I'm a guitar person, you know, and guitar people often get sucked into this vortex of tube amplifiers. You know, it's like getting dosed with chronoton particles and going back in time to the 60s to when these amps sounded really great.
Well, you know, I've mentioned on many occasions on this podcast, my mate Dave, he's my best friend in the world. He lives up in the Blue Mountains to the west of Sydney. And he and I have been recording his original music for over 20 years now. And just in the last 12 months or so, he's done some very deep learning of his own in how to set a guitar up. And he's actually, you know, bought himself a bunch of woodworking tools and has set up an area in his garage. And he's now basically taken every guitar that he owns, which must be about 10 or 12 different guitars, and he's stripped all of them down and reset everything. And
that's awesome. That is totally awesome. That is a total rabbit hole right there.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
absolutely. And the thing is, even to a guy like me who does not play a musical instrument, I've gone up there and listened to these guitars and just gone, holy crap, that sounds amazing now. You know, like I thought it sounded good before, but now it just sounds phenomenal.
Oh, when the harmonics all line up because you have the neck right and you don't have, you know, your intonation is all good and all that.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm sure he's getting very close to the point now where people are starting to ask him to set their guitars up for them, and it could become a whole side business, except he just doesn't have the time to do it.
That's right.
Hey, listen, before we wrap this up, there's one little anecdote that I want to tell, which is not audio related, but earlier in this episode, you were talking about trying to mimic a 1958 something or other.
Pickup.
Right, and how that could sound completely different to a 1959 pickup. And it reminds me of a photo shoot I was doing a couple of years ago where I was contacting somebody, a guy who was an armaments specialist. He'd been a consultant on the movie The Matrix. And I was talking to him about how I wanted to do this photo shoot. And I wanted to have this guy who was like a cowboy. And it was meant to be post-American Civil War. And I was, you know, asking about what type of gun it should be and yada yada. And he was saying, well, you know, the Civil War finished in, you know, 1865 or 66 or whatever it was. He said, you need to know what year you want. And I'm like, dude, I don't care. And he's going, well, no, seriously. He said, gun technology in those days was changing as rapidly as computer technology is today.
Wow.
And the guns that came out in 1867 were completely outdated by 1868. And it was just God. Like, wow.
Look, I know nothing about guns, but I know that when you have, I would guess that in a war, people are trying to change and upgrade technology very quickly, obviously, to give themselves an edge. You know,
of course.
You know, I've seen the same thing in movies or TV shows. You might see a Ford Mustang on the screen, and the sound effect might come from a Camaro. And
yeah,
you know,
right.
And a sharp producer will listen to that and go, stop. That sounds like the Camaro I have parked outside. You need to go get an effect from a Mustang and put that in your sound effects. You know,
wow.
Masters.
Wow.
I've seen that happen, you know.
And you know what? That kind of does not surprise me, because it would be very easy, if you're not an aficionado of that type of thing, then you would go, it's a V8 car. It's the same capacity. That's close enough. But to someone who lives and breathes that as their passion, it would be very obvious to them to say, no, that ain't a Mustang. Yeah, that's a Camaro.
Someplace people get caught in sound effects editing is, you know, oftentimes they'll put birds in the background, and you know, like if it's an outdoor scene at a park, they'll have birds. Let's hope they're birds that live in the same
region
as what you have on screen.
yep, absolutely.
Because oops, and another thing that they do with sound effects editing in movies and TV shows. They always put the lightning and the thunder in sync with each other, whereas it never really is in real life.
I know. I know. That bugs me no end every time I see it. In fact, it's interesting side note to that. Max and I were watching a movie just a couple of nights ago called The Wall. And this was a movie I'd not heard of, and we were just looking for something to watch on Google Play Movies and TV, and found this as a rental and went, oh yeah, that looks pretty good. It's about a sniper and his spotter who get trapped in the middle of Iraq, and the spotter ends up hiding behind a crumbling brick wall, and there's nowhere to run because there's an enemy sniper who knows that he's there and is just waiting for him to pop his head up, and he's going to be gone. And really interesting movie. And what I loved was there's a scene close to the beginning where the American sniper says, I'm going to walk down to this area. And the spotter is going, no, don't do it, don't do it. And the sniper walks down there, and he's standing, and suddenly he gets hit with a bullet, and then about a second later, you hear the pew.
That's great.
And I said to Max, I said, oh, how good is that? That they put the sound effect, you know, a second later to allow for the fact that this bullet has traveled faster than the speed of sound for, you know, well over a second, from the muzzle of the rifle to the time it's hit this guy, and then, you know, there's a good second before the sound arrives, and you never see that, you know, you never hear that, or at least very infrequently in movies, and I loved that.
Well, I just think that most people will go cross-eyed when that happens, and they'll go, what happened there? Because people don't remember that sound travels really slow compared to light.
Yeah, you know, and bullets.
And bullets, indeed so. Everybody's used to seeing thunder and lightning be in sync in a TV or a movie, but we've tried, you know, putting that stuff more like real life, and, you know, people go, nah, put it back where it was, you know.
So, really?
Oh, yeah.
No, I would love to see the lightning flash happening a second or two before you hear the thunder roll. Because to me, that's far more believable, you know.
Well, I'm sure we're going to get a lot of letters that give instances where it's been done correctly to make a liar out of me, and that's fine. Go ahead on. But most of my experience has been that they do it, or they put them in sync.
Yeah, for sure.
You know.
Mate, this has been a great chat, as always. I know we've sort of rambled across a lot of different topics, and I think we should make a commitment here and now that the very next episode – we will talk compression.
Okay.
We will talk about the different types of compressors, the different topologies, and how those things work, and and you know, and if we get to attack time, release time, threshold, and all that stuff in that conversation, great. And if we don't, we'll hold that over to the following episode.
All right. Well, everybody, you know, get ready for some nerd speak.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Totally. Good to chat, Doc.
Always.
All right, mate. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
All right, man. See ya. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Sign language. Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@signlanguagepodcast.com.